Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
And that, my friends, of course, was the voice of Brian Brown, who is the creator of the Brown Briefly. Together, we, the Brieflys, try to keep Brian's creative flame alive by bringing you every week another episode of what we hope is intelligent discussion of current events faced with humor and empathy, and always guided by Brian's mantra of less is more, more or less. Gosh, I remember the first time I heard him say that. It totally cracked me up. What a guy. We do miss him every day. So let me introduce the Brieflys. I'm going to start out with, I'm Truman O'Brien. I'm the sitting behind the big red switch here, former airline pilot and now a pilot of the airways. And sitting next to me is my my partner, my mediator, moderator, and a man who is not afraid to get his hands dirty, and my airplane partner, Craig Bellis. Good morning, Craig.
Good morning, Truman. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm having fun today, by golly. I was going to say zooming in from home, but by gosh, he's right here in the studio. Is Bruce Holman? Easy for me to say.
Right.
Historian extraordinaire at our globetrotting guardian of the galaxy, and as of recently, official party animal. I mean, boy, what a party! Good morning, Bruce.
Hey, it's great to be here.
And sitting right next to Bruce is Amy Dreher. She's in the studio today. She's our newest member. And now, what is this future overwater traveler? What is that? Do you know?
I do not know, but I'm excited to find out. Tell me more. Are we going to discover that over the course of the hour?
I guess we may. I don't know. Somebody wrote that.
She's going to be the fairy maiden.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's
yes,
what it is.
Yes,
I got
yes.
it now. Okay,
I've been the overwater, yes, and I will be back visiting our friends at Fauntleroy this next week.
All right. We're going to hear a lot more about that before the hour is over. So also zooming in from his home up above Burton, there is the voice of Indivisible Vachon and the Vachon Climate Action Group, who's striving to create a livable planet overseen by a government we can all appreciate, or at least tolerate, for crying out loud, Kevin Jones. Good morning, Kevin.
Hey, it's good to be here, making sure the Zoom airwaves are connected to the Gene Bosch downtown studio.
We are. We hear you loud and clear, by golly. So as our usual practice, we need to check in with everybody and see what they've been up to this week. And Craig, let's start with you. What have you been up to?
Well, I had a great week. Our son Nick came up from Ashland for a visit here on Friday and Saturday, and we took a little trip down Point Robinson and checked out the troll.
Oh, cool.
He had never seen the troll. He was duly impressed. That was fun. And then, of course, we went to the Heritage Museum's gala, which we might talk about a little more later, but what a great party. Bruce, our very own Bruce Holman, was there speaking and helping to run the show as he has been doing for years and years.
And I think you're the one that commented it was really short and sweet.
I did. I listened to Bruce's comments and I leaned over to you, Truman, and I said, that was fabulous. It was short and pointless.
I mean, short. Yeah, you did not say that.
I did, jokingly.
Yeah, but that was great.
I resemble that. Right?
And then weekend ended off on a little more somber note. I went to the Sportsman's Club for a memorial to our own John Deere Bill Mann memorial.
Yeah.
And that was a really nice gathering, people talking about Bill Mann and his brother, who are island treasures.
Willie and Harold.
And are not with us anymore. Used to bale our hay many, many years.
Yeah, so. Great guy. And he could do anything with that part.
Well, he was an inventor. He could he could invent things, and he, you know, he'd keep that baler together literally with
twine
with
and twine, yeah, bubble
that's
gum.
Right, and duct tape.
Yeah. Interesting side note. It was Bill Mann who bought his post hole digger on the back of his tractor up here and dug the hole for the poetry post in the Vashon Commons.
Oh, no kidding.
He did everything.
He did. Between him and Doc Easley.
I was just going to say. Yeah, amazing. All right, Amy, how about you?
Yeah, I was in Denver this week and had the opportunity to go to the reopened world-famous landmark Casa Bonita. So there is Denver and Vashon share a wonderful Mexican restaurant name and wonderful Mexican restaurant. It is not affiliated, but Casa Bonita in Denver is sort of a cross between a theme park and a restaurant. And it feels like, you know, when you walk in, it feels like you're walking into Pirates of the Caribbean in Disneyland. Yeah. And it's got, you know, it's all fabricated, but they have cliff divers and they have like statuettes and they have an arcade and they have... It's an experience. Like, just a restaurant, it's an experience. And you get your ticket and you go in line and you order, you know, one of five options and they serve it up for you right there. But this quote unquote new Casa Bonita is a reopening. It was a kind of landmark Denver institution for many, you know, many decades. I think it opened in the 70s. And it's this giant pink building in a strip mall, right? It's like next to a like Big Lots and nail salon. Yeah. But it's this, you know, almost, I think it's a like 2 or 3 story tower. You know, giant pink building, you know, with a total colonial facade. You go in, and the old one was famous for how bad the food was, right? Like it just or infamous. And you know, but you went there for the show to see these, you know, indoor cliff diving, you know, shows that would go on. So then it went out of business, and a couple of years ago, the creators of South Park bought it. Matt and Trey bought it and gave it an overhaul and a facelift. And most importantly, I think a very smart marketing spin and made it exclusive. And now you get in these lotteries of 1,300 people for the opportunity to purchase your tickets.
Oh, wow. Exclusive.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. So we went and did that. And I highly recommend it, especially if you have kids. If you're in the Denver metro area and you can get your hands on some tickets, it's a pretty hilarious experience. And kind of shockingly affordable. It's like $40 a person.
Wow.
And you get like a full dinner and, you know, the dinner and a show, so to speak. But
you're talking to guys who are a lot older than you are. $40 for a dinner.
Oh, nowadays.
Yeah,
right?
Nothing to it.
Yeah.
You know, maybe
we
should sign them up as underwriters after that particular
kidding.
description.
Yeah, Matt and Trey, if you're listening.
There you go. We need the money. So, Bruce, how about you?
Oh, it's been a good week. I mean, at the gala, we can talk about it in a bit, but it's a wonderful evening. It went really well, and always great to have a Dusty 45 playing music. I mean, hard to sit still when they're playing. But also, last week, my wife Pam had a ruptured appendix, which is this weird sort of thing that she thought she had the stomach flu for a week and then took her in for some tests and, nope. So she was in the hospital a couple days and got her out and get her on antibiotics, get her recovering.
Wow.
But it's a measure. I mean, you guys will remember this. Amy, you may be a little young for this, but... I mean, when we had appendicitis or appendix kind of stuff, you know, when we were kids, they just went in and ripped them out.
Yeah.
No more. Really? I mean, unless it's a rupture into the body cavity, they just let things heal up. You know, they use massive antibiotics, and then in about 6 to 8 weeks, they'll go in and laparoscopically.
Yeah.
You know.
It up.
Deal with her appendix. So,
wow.
But, you know, sort of turning into a nursemaid for a bit and sort of making breakfast and bringing trays up and down the stairs. It's an interesting life that I didn't foresee 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
The most interesting part of that story is what a trooper your wife is. She was at the gala.
She was at the gala.
Something. All right, Kevin, how about you?
It's an interesting week, a little bit of stormy weather, but proving that I can ride a bike and row a boat in wet rain and windy weather. So it's been kind of awesome to be able to get out and about in the natural elements. I also have to say that our listeners, I'm sure, are going to want to be putting this on their calendar Saturday, May 18th, I'm hearing from the group that is creating Beyond Our Bubble, Mobilizing for Democracy Fair. So if you're hanging out in town around the Land Trust building on May 18th between 12 and 2, stop in, because Surge, showing up for racial justice and Indivisible Vashon, they're teaming up to bring you how to get involved and support the democracy that we live in. So and hear a lot from that team, and I really appreciate the work they're doing.
Great, great, terrific. Well, as you guys know, I was on Zoom last week for the briefly, because I was out in Warwick, Rhode Island for my Army unit's reunion. And it was billed as our final reunion. We're all getting too old and lost too many of us. And during our business meeting, which we always have at 10 o'clock in the morning on Tuesday, we all looked at each other and said, why are we quitting? We like this. You know, this is too fun. I mean, the first ones I went to, I think we had 150, 160 people. And this one, I think there are only about 40 of us. So several people, my good buddies couldn't come. But anyway, it was really great fun. And after, I had even more fun. My wife and I drove out to Cape Cod. I'd never been there. Drove all the way out to the end. And Craig, you told me, oh, it's just a beautiful drive and beautiful drive. Well, I have to tell you that, you know, there are no leaves on the trees back there yet. And the daffodils are just starting to come out. I mean, they're at least 3 weeks behind us. I was very surprised about that. And so consequently, we didn't find the drive all that beautiful. It was kind of boring, actually, till we got out to the end. And then, you know, then you get to the sand and everything. That was interesting. And then we came back and we drove up Highway 3A, which is the one that goes up along the coast. Ended up in Plymouth. And I hate to admit it, but I mean, how stupid am I? I didn't realize that's where Plymouth Rock was. It's in Plymouth, you know, duh. But we finally got to see Plymouth Rock, you know, the chisel 1620 on. That was kind of cool. But then we had just the most amazing meal. I know, isn't that bad? I know, I'm so stupid.
We're here laughing.
I know.
Do you happen to know where Blarney Stone is?
I do know where that is.
And you know who's buried in Grantstone?
I do know. Yeah. Oh, gosh. I mean, really, truly, you know, seriously, when we got there, I went, well, how stupid can you be, you know? Oh boy! Anyway, but that was fun. But then, when we found out that there in Plymouth, there are 126 restaurants in Plymouth.
Really? And
it's a little tiny town.
Wow!
But at least that's what they had on their marker there. But anyway, we found a restaurant called Salt that was just over the top, fantastic. Oh, amazingly good. Anyway, spent the night, drove up the next day to Boston. Spent the afternoon in Boston trying to get over that meal, and then went to took the water taxi over to the Chart House, which is a wonderful restaurant, which is located in the second oldest building in Boston, the oldest being Paul Revere's house. But it's just a really unique experience and a wonderful meal, of course. But anyway, that was my week. I had a heck of a good time. Of course, I was exhausted. 5.5 hour flight when you come back, you know. It was something else. Kevin, you had some?
I was curious about the Plymouth Rock thing. I've heard rumors that it actually was relocated to that location in Plymouth from the original landing.
That is true.
Maybe Bruce can tell us if that is actually true.
It is true. I happen to know that. Yeah. And in fact, it was just a big rock that was mentioned, you know, in the landing. And then, what was it, 18 or 1730 something that they carved the 1620 on it?
Oh, you mean that wasn't carved in there when the pilgrims landed?
Yeah, they got out with a chisel and chiseled it right in there. Yeah, yeah. Well, they moved it to the park in the center of town and broke it when they did. Broke the end of it off. And then and it was in the 1800s, I think.
Oops.
Not exactly. they moved it to its current location and built a big mausoleum over the top of it. I mean, it's something else to see, but kind of a tourist trap, but it's cool.
Yeah. Like most things in history, you know, it's not what we think it was, and it never was.
Exactly. But it's still cool. I mean, I'm glad I got to see it, you know. So, hey, you know, we always try and find out what today is. Well, today is Shelter Pet Adoption Day, nationwide. So you folks, if you need a pet, go out to VIP and get yourself a dog or a cat or a donkey or a horse or whatever. And but today is pet adoption day. Also, I looked up, there's some kind of interesting things that happened on this day. For example, in 1492, Christopher Columbus was given the royal commission by the Spanish monarchs Isabella and Ferdinand to equip his fleet for the New World. And now we're finding out that maybe even the Romans were here before. I mean, Bruce, you might know about that. But also in 1492, Spain announced that it will expel all Jews. And I, you know, I was in Toledo several years ago. And interesting, I've got a whole bunch of notes. I'm not going to go into all of this. But, you know, the Moors invaded Spain in 711. In fact, on January 2nd in 1492, the king surrendered to the Moorish king surrendered to in Granada to the Spanish forces, and they were finally expelled in 1502, I guess it was total. But what's interesting is, in Toledo, is that there are three churches there. There's a mosque, there's a synagogue, and a cathedral. And of course, now they're all Catholic. I mean, they've all been converted. And two of them are actually museums. But fascinating to go through those. If you go through the synagogue in particular, they have just a ton of historic items there. It's a very, very interesting thing to see. That's why I threw these two things in.
Did you check out anything on the sword-making industry of Toledo?
I did. I have. Yeah. I mean, when I was there,
yeah,
it's amazing. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Everywhere you go, you find, you know, they've made these famous swords. So as long as we're on the expelling the Jews in 1563, they were expelled from France by order of King Charles V, which I thought was interesting. So you know the persecution of the Jews didn't start in 1939. It's been going on for a long time. In 1789, on this date, George Washington was inaugurated as the first president of the United States in Federal Hall in New York City. How about that?
Wow.
I got two more items. In 1803, Chancellor Robert Livingston and James Monroe signed the Louisiana Purchase Treaty for a cost of $15 million, and basically double the size of the U.S. You have anything to add to that, Bruce?
No, it was one of the most significant sort of Western advances of the United States, that sort of what would become manifest destiny. And it sort of just opened people's minds to the sense of why not control this whole continent.
Right.
And so, yeah, it was a very significant. And, of course, it led to Lewis and Clark. You know, it led to, you know, sort of the population of the West, led to conflict with Mexico.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, Mexico had heard about the Lewis and Clark expedition, and they actually sent a military force to try and intercept Lewis and Clark.
Really?
You know, because they, you know, it had not, they were worried about the U.S. expanding
California.
Into California.
Sure.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I mean, the ramifications and sort of what we have today is that kind of composite of many different sort of cultures and many different areas being, you know, in what we see as the, quote, United States. And,
yeah.
And of course, we're not always united as we think we
yes,
are.
Especially lately.
And it's also, in that sense, going back to your comment about the three religious buildings in right. Toledo. How much the world goes through these periods of very open acceptance of differences, and then this sort of calcification, and then it's sort of like, and we see that going on right now in the United States, you know, this sort of, you know, resistance to change, just sort of like, let's go back to a monoculture rather than a multiculture. And it's a constant sort of struggle in the world and with human beings, I think.
Yeah, well, I think that's fascinating. They, you know, the Moors, like you said, the Moors, when they came in 711, they were really very tolerant and very interested in saving the technology and all of them, you know, what mathematics and literature and all of those things. So I think that's really interesting. And the architecture that they brought also was really fascinating. But anyway, thank you for that, Bruce. That's really interesting. All right, my last date, 1945. Adolf Hitler commits suicide along with Eva Braun in the Führerbunker in Berlin after the Red Army captured the city. So there you go. So today is our is what we're referring to as the Truman Show, and I don't know how that came about, but it's basically we don't have a small talk guest. And so they said, okay, Truman, you have to go in and put something together since you don't have a guest. So I've tried to go back and look through some of the other scripts that we have where we didn't, things that we didn't get to cover. And so I got to, first let's start out with local, and that's, of course, the Heritage Museum event. We know who, I mean, Bruce, you were there, obviously, and Craig and I were, Kevin, you didn't make it. You had something else you had to do. But listen, you really missed it. Yeah, I did have a question. Mm-hmm. Who catered that? Who was it, did the catering?
I'm not the person to ask.
No. Well, yeah. I thought the food was great. And the rowing club did all of the serving?
The rowing club, yeah, did all the serving, yeah. Actually, the menu was kind of a 1950s menu. So it was, dessert was chocolate cake with Jell-O.
Yeah.
And marshmallows. And,
which is delicious. Right?
Swedish meatballs, all those kind of 50s foods. I thought they did a great job trying to recreate that.
It was, and Craig had his leather sweater on. He looked great. And Lynette had her poodle skirt. Which was awesome.
Lots of poodle skirts. Stuff.
Yeah.
And the saddle shoes, I was very impressed.
Yeah. The people oftentimes ask us where we got our outfits, and we go, well, our closet.
Never throw clothes away. Exactly. You'll never know when you need them, right?
Exactly. That's
funny. You'll need them the week after you throw them away.
Yeah. So this is what, I don't know where this came from, but a topic that we didn't feel last week, but is the question is, so how long is too long to take a nap, and who says so? is that from you, Amy? Is that where that came from?
It is not, but I mean, who doesn't have strong feelings about naps?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And was it Linda Nygaard who said that she's getting to the point where she doesn't have enough time to take her regular 2 naps a day?
Yeah. Well, I never took naps. I mean, I just didn't. But my dad always would say, I wonder how long it'll take me to take about a 15-minute nap. Kevin?
Well, I have to admit that this was from a show script that I had, talking to Susie about, hey, what should we talk about? And this was sort of a joke on her, actually, because she is a champion napper and a champion sleeper. And I can tell you, I'm slowly learning the art of making sure you get enough sleep, because it's been too many years, and it's so refreshing, right, to get a good night's sleep. But my wife is a model of relaxation and enjoying a well-earned night's rest and a midday reprieve from the busyness of our lives.
There you go.
A lot of study done on sleep generally these days, and how important it is not to sleep too little or to sleep too much.
Yeah.
It's funny you mentioned Plymouth. And if you go just south of Plymouth Rock, you come to Plymouth Village, and they have they show the beds that the individuals slept on. They're all about 4 feet long.
Yeah, because
they're all sitting up because of consumption.
Oh, really?
They were afraid they were going to drown if they laid flat on their back all night long. And the other thing about that is that bifurcated sleep was much more common, where you got up for a couple hours in the middle of the night.
I'm getting into that.
I know. Some of us voluntarily and some involuntarily.
Exactly. Yeah, 3 o'clock, you wake up, and, oh, well, I'm wide awake. I might as well get up and, do some work. And then a couple hours later, you go again. Yeah. So I call it my after breakfast nap.
You don't want to feel guilty about sleeping.
It's a good thing. It's a good thing. All right. Also, statewide, I see that the Republican National Committee or the Republican State Committee meeting in Spokane recently made it part of their platform to do away with democracy. Did you see that?
I did not.
Oh my gosh!
In those words.
They're going to get rid of democracy.
And what?
Well, when I first heard that, I thought, what the heck are they talking about? Well, then I got to thinking about it and did a little reading. And, of course, what they're talking about is the difference between a democracy and a republic.
Oh, right.
And we are truly a republic is what we are. And we're, and Bruce, you can probably speak to this. But they're, It finally dawned on me, well, it's not quite as bad as it sounds, but still not great, you know?
It's that whole concept of the concept of direct democracy.
Exactly.
How much power do the voters have? And the American system is a federal system. It's a republic, and it's set up basically to insulate, you know, representatives and senators and the government and the president from the direct election by citizens. You have the Electoral College. I mean, it wasn't until the 19-teens that senators were elected by popular vote. They were elected by state legislators, and some states want to go back to that.
Yeah.
And it's all that an emphasis on and isolating, basically, those responsible for government from the people they represent.
Exactly.
And creating sort of levels of if you will, indirect democracy.
Right.
To me right now, because we have the potential to have direct democracy, you know, with mail-in voting, with electronic voting. I mean, there's all kinds of ways that, you know, there's no reason that we can't have everybody vote in every election, you know.
Well, except that, you know, those folks in nursing homes, they're not going to live very much longer anyway, so why should they vote? Do you hear that guy? Politician?
No, really, yeah,
unbelievable. Right. Unbelievable.
Well, in California, they would argue they're going to vote twice anyway.
Anyway, so I just thought that was very interesting, and I appreciate your take on it. And Kevin?
Well, it's a very slippery slope.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard for me to take this as an innocent sounding. Oh, we just mean to emphasize the republic.
Absolutely.
Because there's too much research that's been done. I will go back to How Democracies Die and Democracy in Chains to show the research that's been done on those who are motivating the Republican Party to take that position. But I also noticed that they're insisting that we should also hand count our ballots. Machine counting, no mail-in. Make sure to hand count those ballots. So I'm not quite sure where they're headed with that. But
that's a great way to assure the validity of...
Oh, good Lord. Can you imagine?
All those hanging chads.
Right, absolutely.
Those hanging chads.
So weeks and months to decide an election.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, there was also a very earnest woman talking about how the military should stop spreading democracy around the world. Our military should stop doing that, which I don't know how much is a tip of the hat to our non-democratic nations around the country that some of the conservative legislators seem to be posing up to. So, I was disturbed by it and continue to be so, and hopefully... in November, we'll show who cares about our democracy by what happens at the ballot box.
Exactly. And the other thing, that they did not endorse a candidate for governor, which I thought was pretty interesting. I guess neither one of them were MAGA enough or something. I don't know what the deal on that was, but I saw that, found that to be interesting. Okay, so let's move on up to a federal level. And we've got the Trump trial. The Trump trial, Trump trial. So Craig, what's your take on the first ever criminal trial?
What's my take? There's just so many facets, and I'm not going to talk about all of them. Let me just say, it seems to be moving apace. The prosecution and the defense have to be careful not to bog down, and so far they have to a large degree. I don't know if all the my fellow briefleys have been on juries before, but there is a real psychology, of course, to keeping the attention. They say that trials are battles of atmospheres rather than facts sometimes, and you've got to pace your witnesses so that you don't put people to sleep, and that's what the prosecution has been doing yesterday. And the day yesterday, they had one that could put you to sleep. Typically, the economic experts are the ones where everybody's nodding off. In addition to the former president, so you got to mix that up as the prosecutor. You got boring stuff, but you got to get those facts in, more exciting stuff that the jurors kind of like hearing about. The defense has the problem that I've had, and many attorneys have had, is they have a rather active
a client who wants them to attack every little statement that they think might be not exactly correct, all of which is wasted on a jury. It's big picture stuff. When I tell new attorneys, you know, about trial practice, I go, you know, less is more. More or less.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, and then the gag order.
$9,000.
Yeah, well, they can't do really anything in terms of money.
Just did. Yeah, right now it's $1,000 per. Is that what they
did? Yeah, $1,000 per. That's the maximum.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, $9,000 total is what he ordered because he found that one of the things was not a violation of the gag order. But he did. The judge did tell Trump that that you know he has the perfect right to put him in jail. Problem there is the practical PR and political aspect of it. A lot of commentators think that that Trump is dying for the judge to put him in jail for a while.
Good fundraiser, boy.
I'm not suggesting the judge is motivated by politics. The judge is motivated by protecting the process, protecting the witnesses, and protecting the jury. And if he gives the former president a new giant argument to make, it can affect all of those things he's trying to protect. Yeah. So, you know, there's a side of me that says, come on, treat him like any other person in court. But at the same time, the underlying analysis is the protection of this of the process, the jury, and the witnesses.
Now, somebody was saying that there's a possibility that, I mean, since he hadn't ruled yet, that he could wait until the trial was over.
That was me.
Was that you saying
that? Yeah, that was me. I told you that.
That was brilliant.
Well, it must be true.
It must be. No, I actually saw that on TV.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But you did say.
I did. I thought that one of the ways, there are creative ways the judge can deal with this violation of the gag order. And one is to actually, one, reserve judgment till the end of the trial on what he's going to do, and he did suggest that he's going to review all of this at the end of the trial, so as not to delay the trial.
Right.
The other is to, and I don't think this is going to work. You may have heard about this. Is moves the defendant around in the courtroom, move him to the back of the courtroom, for example.
Really?
Yeah, where he's not. You know, he's not whispering and giving asides that the jury hears all the time. That's distracting from the witness's testimony and affecting the jury's and the witness's testimony because he's glaring at him and commenting on him and that sort of thing.
They do one of those glass boxes like they have in Russia.
The juries in Nuremberg.
Nuremberg.
That's right.
Yeah. Interesting. All right, another.
Kevin.
Oh, sorry, Kevin. Go ahead.
Well, I will make just a couple of comments. For those who are fond of having listened to the committee who looked into the insurrection at the Capitol building and remember sound bites, I'll say Liz Cheney was wrong.
Hmm.
Trump is actually sort of a petulant child, and I think we're kind of seeing some of that behavior. So, but moving on from that, Craig, I'm curious. So I think I know what would constitute a hung jury. You might be able to let our listeners know exactly what would happen to cause that outcome. And then what are the consequences or likelihood of a retrial in the event of a hung jury? Is it possible and is it likely? I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Well, it's purely up to the let me start at the beginning. Hung jury basically is where there's a requirement that you have a unanimous verdict, like they do in New York, and at least one of the jurors goes the opposite direction, says innocent. I think he's innocent. I'm holding out. We're not all. And if that's the case, you don't have a unanimous verdict, and that's a hung jury. Double jeopardy does not apply in that instance. Prosecutor has the discretion as to whether or not to do it all over again. And that happens more often than you might think. And whether or not the prosecutor would do it in that case is, you know, debatable. I have a feeling he or she would, especially if it's only one juror. So
they just impanel a whole new jury and start over. Huh?
Correct.
Wow.
To start from scratch and find a juror that's never heard of any of these people.
Yeah, right.
No, that's another point I just mentioned. There's all this talk about, you can't get an impartial jury in New York City because everybody's a Democrat and they all know me and whatnot, and therefore it just can't be done. And I say to myself, have you ever been in any small town in America that has a courthouse where everybody doesn't know one another?
Yeah,
and they have jurors. There are probably 100 trials or more going on right now where everybody in the jury box knows the defendant.
It's like that joke about the little old lady that where the attorney says, do you know the defendant? And she goes off about what a bad person he is, names all the stuff he's done. Well, do you know the defense attorney? Yeah, I know him, and this is all the bad stuff. Cheated on his wife and blah, blah, blah. And the judge says, if one of you idiots ask her if she knows me, you're both going to be held in contempt.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, that was great. Okay, so Arizona. Oh, boy. First of all, I don't think we had a chance to talk about the Arizona Supreme Court recognizing the 1864 law banning abortion, basically in the state, you know, all abortion, and the fact that the Attorney General says that she's not going to prosecute anybody. Period. And so, what's the deal there, Craig? You're on again.
It's interesting. The Attorney General generally doesn't have the authority to say nobody can prosecute.
Right.
However, what's her name? The governor, Hobbs, did a flip-flop on this whole issue and said, oh, we've got to turn over this Supreme Court opinion because she's seeing which way the wind's blowing.
Yeah.
And the wind's blowing in favor of abortion rights.
Right.
So she enters an executive order saying that all enforcement with regards to this law is in the hands of the Attorney General.
Oh.
Okay. Now, that's not the end of it. There are many very conservative county prosecutors in Arizona, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I haven't followed it right up to the day, but they are seriously considering bringing a lawsuit to try to overturn that executive order so they have the authority to prosecute.
Hmm.
There's also a motion on the part of the state attorney general's office to overturn a motion for reconsideration at the state Supreme Court level, which I hold very little hope of, especially since the Arizona Supreme Court was packed, if you will. They added two or three new judges here over the last 2 years, all of whom are Republican appointees. And this resulted in the opinion that came out here a month ago or so. And finally, there are signatures for an initiative. I don't know if they were calling it an initiative or a referendum in Arizona, but where they're basically going to have it up for vote as to whether or not Arizona turns basically back to pre-Dobbs, and it's an issue of viability.
All right. Right. And not necessarily time, but...
There were presumptions of, you know, second trimester kind of thing.
Amy, you have any thoughts on this, or other than
pull
your hair out?
Yeah, right. Just sort of like, oh, well, bodily autonomy. It would have been great to be a woman in 1863 when I had more control over my bodily autonomy than I have now, right? It's, you know, in kind of looking at this, it's easy. There's sort of these state by state things, and it's easy to not see that this was a vastly orchestrated effort, right? That these laws were either, you know, the anti-choice movement, either made sure there was a law on the books that could be enforced with the fall of Roe, or they introduced laws that could be enforced after the fall of Roe. And, you know, there are, of course, patchworks of bad laws because they are not intended to govern a healthy body of people, right? They are not intended, you know, to sort of create an outcome for a community. They're intended for a kind of perverted political purpose of controlling certain people, you know, in constituencies. They're not to be fairly applied to everyone for the good of the body politic, right? They're to execute a certain purpose. And, you know, shocking, in Idaho, right, there's a Supreme Court case now about, you know, the new Idaho law that is just sort of ridiculously written. And, you know, you know you're doing something weird with your anti-choice laws when Amy Comey Barrett says is, you know, sort of shocked and calls you out, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, that's what she did with the Idaho law, sort of saying, so wait a minute, you know, you told me that this law was going to be enforced sort of equitably, and now you're telling me that women who go into emergency rooms, whether or not their physician is prosecuted, will be on a case-by-case basis,
yeah,
right? And that is terrible, terrible right. laws, right? And so it is very fascinating to sort of think, and I think it, if it either raises the question or begs the question, I think it raises the question, right, of how these laws came to be in the first place, right? We're looking back at 1864 and what was going on in 1864, right? And it is the consolidation of physicians' power, of white men, right, having power as physicians, and sort of falling birth rates. Right. And so really, you know, mandating that women again are sort of bear the brunt of, you know, capitalist expansion in a country. And, you know, I think it's interesting because, you know, history, if those who control history control the future. Right. If you think this is the way it's always been, it is much easier to sort of say this is the way. And this sort of like, quote unquote, moral ambiguity over abortion. Really, only even the churches weren't involved until the late 1800s, 1850s in America, right? So we always think, oh, the Catholic Church, right? That's the standard bearer of morality around this. They didn't even get involved until the late 1800s, right?
Bruce, you have?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're right on, Amy. And when you look at Arizona in 1864, you have to question what's going on. I mean, it was a territory. I mean, most of the women in Arizona in 1864 were either Dine or Navajo women. There were very few white women in Arizona at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And the white men who were there were largely miners and ranchers and escaping the Civil War. You know, the guy who wrote the law was sort of fleeing service in the Confederacy and moved west so he didn't have to go into the army. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating. I mean, he had four wives. You know, one was 12, one was 15, and one was 14 years old. God. And this is the guy writing the law about controlling women's bodies.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You know, and it's also wrapped up into all kinds of things about control, about drugs, about, you know, who can prosecute who. And so it's fascinating when you go back and you look at what was in 1864 in Arizona and why this sort of itinerant preacher from the South escaping the Civil War who has a series of child brides writes a law about abortion.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Amazing.
One other quick point, just so the people are totally up to date on this. You know, the Arizona legislature tried to overturn the effects of this case twice and failed. And then an hour later, three Republicans came over to the Democratic side in the State House of Representatives and did, in fact, vote to do away with the 1864 Act and return to the 15, I guess, week, whatever rule that they had prior to that, which is not a great rule, to say the least. And now it's going to the Senate, the state Senate.
Right,
and the thought is that they will also overturn it. The hope is, and then Hobbs, the governor, will sign that and will undo what the Arizona Supreme Court did.
Wow. Okay, Greg, buckle up,
Greg. I'm kind of wondering on that point that you last made if. You know, it seems like whenever women's reproductive rights is on the ballot, we learn, regardless of whether the state is, you know, conservative or progressive, that women's reproductive rights win. So I'm just curious if we think that this latest action by the legislature, third time's a charm, if you will, is them trying to just dodge a bullet and put their head down at this point to say, oh, looks like we riled people up a little bit too much on this issue. Maybe we'll just maybe try to get through this next election and then bring it on again. Any fears that that might be what's behind your latest move?
Yes.
In a word. Yeah,
there's only three Republicans of a majority House representative that went along with overturning the Supreme Court opinion. I don't really see any, you know, radical change of behavior there.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm personally hoping this is an issue that the country needs to address, and that, you know, we as a nation need to have our wishes expressed, and we're a democracy, so you would expect that that we would prevail in that. I'm glad you mentioned, Amy, Idaho. I saw an article about the percentage of physicians who do reproductive health care leaving the state. I don't know how many even numbers that is. The percentages were pretty high. I don't know if that's, you know, one or two people or dozens.
Mm-hmm. But, and it's not an unintended effect, right?
Healthcare deserts.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It is healthcare desert. And this, you know, it is the cruelty is the point often with things like this. And, you know, the chilling effect that really surrounds these kinds of things, and whether or not you'll be prosecuted as a doctor is almost academic, right? Once you start, and who wants to go into reproductive care? And, you know, when you meet providers, abortion providers, they are exceptionally courageous folks who, you know, often over the years have taken their lives in their hands to provide reproductive care for women. And that is a travesty in this country.
Yep. Ooh, well, that was easy. all right, so we're staying with Arizona. So how about the indictment of the fake electors? I just heard something rather interesting about that, the one of the fake electors who's been indicted has been appointed to the
head up the Republican
National Committee. Yeah, is going to be a member of the Republican National Committee.
Are these the dissenting electors, or?
These are the fake electors, the ones who they appointed, who they said, yeah, we're the real electors. Which weren't, and they've been indicted, right? And now one of these guys has been appointed to the Republican National Committee. It's like, what? How in the world?
You know, and Craig, maybe you can add to this too. But I mean, you've always heard the phrase, you know, the wheels of justice grind slowly, but they do grind and they do work their way through. What I see is out of the January 6th, out of the 2020 election and the fake electors and all that, I mean, there is this process going on in the background of legal, you know, legally taking people to court and sort of charging them with offenses. Yeah. And it takes a long time. One of my questions is, I mean, we're used to quicker responses, and we're used to sort of quicker kinds of sort of gratifications of what we want. But in effect, I mean, is this unusually slow, Craig, that, you know, it's taken 4 years to get Trump into a courtroom? It's taken 4 years to get fake electors in Michigan and Arizona and other places into the legal system. Or is that sort of just normal and we're used to things being instant gratification?
Well, we're used to either 30-minute or 60-minute resolutions from the television shows
exactly.
We watch. But you have to kind of take it on a case-by-case basis. Federal cases generally take longer. State cases can move quickly. The deal is the prosecutors want to get their cases really together because they have to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. And the defendants, as you know, they don't have to say a word. They don't have to make an opening statement. They don't have to put on any witnesses. Nothing. It's all up to the prosecutor. So the prosecutor is going to take their time. Now, the fence might very well be really happy with that, because the old adage is justice delayed is justice denied. Well, that's not the defense attorney's adage. The defense attorney's adage is justice delayed is justice granted. Some of these cases are definitely taking longer. Our attorney general probably waited a little and was a little more careful than he needed to be, especially since he ended up appointing a special prosecutor, Mr. Smith. So it's taking. And then you might ask yourself, why in the Arizona and Michigan big electric cases, why isn't the former president named in those? He's just named as an unnamed
co-conspirator.
Yeah. And that's a discretionary move on the part of the prosecutor. Say, you know, police can arrest the people they want to arrest. They don't have to arrest everybody who commits a crime in their presence. Prosecutors don't have to prosecute everybody who comes before them. Well, a lot of discretion built into the system.
Two things. Did you see the woman in, I think it was in New York, who's a DA, and she got pulled over for speeding, and she flashed her badge and said, "Hey, I'm the DA." And the guy said, "I'm going to write you a ticket. You know, you were speeding. I mean, you went 20 miles over the speed limit." And she said, "I'm the person that's going to prosecute." The person that is like... But she finally had to apologize, and you know, because it was all on tape.
There's a bunch of those. There's the county commissioner, the county executives, not Dow. a guest of ours a couple of months ago. Yeah. But where they get stopped, and it's all on tape, and they go, "Do you know who I am? Are you serious?"
Yeah.
Then it's the classic, "Do you know who I am?" And then the police calls in and goes, "I've got a guy out here who doesn't know who he is."
Yeah, exactly. Kevin.
So apparently there is I think it's a Kevin Jones who works in like the Washington State Patrol Crime Lab. Mm. And a buddy of mine who's an instructor at a community college took his students there and got this guy's card. And he says, "Could I have one or two more?" Sure, why not? And so he emails me one. And he says, "Next time you get pulled over, Kevin, you need to show them this card. Washington State Patrol and see if you can dodge any ticket."
I would definitely advise against that.
Yeah. And your legal advisor.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that is good, though. I like it. I like the idea. All right, so you guys sent me a number of topics via email, and I'm sorry that I didn't get them recorded here. But somebody want to take one of those on, Bruce?
Well, I'd like to hear more from Amy about what's going on with fairies and music group.
Sorry, I missed that.
I mean, that's, when I commute off the island, it's usually at the South End. And South End service has become remarkably predictable, mm-hmm. which is not always the case and hasn't been. So what's going on and what do you see happening over the next 6-12 months? And mm-hmm. will we ever get new ferries before 5 or 6 years from now?
Right. Well, it's interesting, right? The Republicans played a brilliant card last fall in saying, "Hey, we should bring diesel ferries on," here we are being the problem solvers and sort of, stirring the pot there. But to give credit where credit is due, Washington State Ferries has said, "Hey, crewing, it takes time." And while we have had some unpredictability at the South End of the last couple of months, it really has stabilized. It's true. It takes time to hire people and train them up and, credit where credit is due. Bringing on more crew and the ferries do have a much more comprehensive, sort of legitimate plan to bring people through the system. And we have to give that time to work. But we do have a couple things coming up for sure. The Fauntleroy dock renovation is absolutely going to affect us. And right now there's sort of an online open house, and we'll get that posted to Chamber social media and on the ferry Islanders for Ferry Action page. And there will also be community meetings May 7th and 8th that will be open, Zoom meetings that are open to the community. And we'll encourage folks to listen in on those. They're about an hour of your time, and they really will answer so many questions.
Will those
about the
be
dog.
Joint Vashon Fauntleroy meetings, or how does that structure?
Yeah, for sure. So those are, it's the community action group, the CAG group of the Fauntleroy Dock, and it has representatives from Southworth, Vashon, and Fauntleroy. And those folks, I believe, are listed on the website. But there are a couple of folks from the Ferry Advisory Committee who are on the Vashon CAG and a number of community members who are on that. And it's just going to have a lot of information. I was fortunate enough to sit in via Zoom on the ferry update that Washington State Ferries gave to the San Juan Islands about their scheduling and the scheduling process and how that works. And, you know, was heartened that the Triangle Route was called out as a priority for schedule fixing, because, you know, getting that two-boat schedule fixed is really going to be really clutch. So looking forward to bringing more information about the timeline around getting our boat schedule fixed as we go forward. And Kevin?
Yeah, and I think you're bringing up the notion of, you know, should we proceed with electric boats versus some other presumably shorter timeline, but Inslee says it's not shorter to go with, you know, a hybrid a diesel electric, because you got to start the whole process over again. The other thing that our friends at Vashon Climate Action Group have done is looked at how much diesel a ferry boat actually burns. And to make it easy on our minds, a year of operating one of our boats, diesel boats on the North End, is equivalent to 830 cars per year that you could otherwise remove from the roadway. And that number doesn't sound too great, too large. But if you consider the fact that the ferry service retires its boats at 60 years old, then that one new diesel ferry is going to basically introduce into the atmosphere the equivalent of 50,000 cars on our roads. So the idea that if you have concerns over the climate, you might think, you know, I'm willing to wait a little bit longer to make sure that I don't introduce that amount of pollution into our climate.
And Vashon, I don't believe, is scheduled to get that first boat, those first boats coming off the line in 2028. We will get our hand-me-downs, as we are, you know, very much used to getting. And, you know, the other question, though, that is raised about bringing on the hybrid, right, because there's diesel, there's hybrid, and there's electric. And, you know, the capacity of the Washington State Ferry System to support hybrid electric vehicles or vessels, if you will. And, you know, will the Fauntleroy Dock have a charging station? It may or may not, because we may or may not be slated for a hybrid or an electric boat. Kevin?
In fact, we talked to WSF about this. Bainbridge, in their climate action plan, is claiming an electric ferry boat. And we thought, well, hey, can't we do that too? And so, you know, we talked to the ferry service about 6 months ago now. And we asked about things like, you know, are you going to put a charging station on Vashon? They're not convinced that they need one, first of all. We also asked about things like, once we have electric boats on the north end of the island, you have this gigantic battery full of electricity if the boat overnights on Vashon. Is there a way we can use that energy source somehow if we have a storm and we don't have power here? So there's a lot of interesting discussions. They weren't really keen on the idea of draining their battery sitting over here on the island. But it opens up some interesting possibilities when you consider that we have those kind of resources now available to help, you know, with power stability.
I have Captain Joe. I just asked Captain Joe to come in and sit for a minute. Captain Joe, we're talking about electric, hybrid electric, or diesel for the ferries.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know if you have an opinion on which is a better system. Or
so you always know that I have an opinion on anything.
I do know that, yes.
So the hybrid electric system is both efficient now and is much better for what it puts out into the atmosphere, and I'm very much in favor of them. But there is a tendency on the part of naval engineers, as against the operators, to overcomplicate. And so it is always my hope that when the engineers develop and design these pieces of equipment, that they keep it simple, because it's not all that complicated. Keep it simple and keep it efficient.
And a question, one quick question is, how about controllability? Do you have better, faster control with electric, or is there much difference?
No, the control systems can be calibrated to whatever the prime mover is, so that you will remember, for example, that the Issaquahs, when they first came out, they had control problems, had nothing to do with the prime mover. And the idea that you keep the control system as simple as possible is also a good thing for both ferries and for icebreakers. And in both cases, we have often not designed them that way.
Exactly. Okay. Thank you very much for jumping in there, Captain Joe. I appreciate that. So, hey, we're about out of time here, guys. I just want to say that next week is Give Big here at KVSH. We're going to be the Hub O' Love, I think they're calling us. And the Brown Briefly is going to have several nonprofits that we're going to interview, and it'll be all day long. And I was just thinking of your, Amy, of your action group there, the ferry meeting. It's going to conflict with that for us, doggone it.
Well, there are, they air at two different times, so you can catch it on the 7th or the 8th, and it'll be the same meeting on the 7th or the 8th. And so, I think it's one's midday and one's evening.
Okay, good, good. The evening one, I guess, would be the one. Well, we are out of time, guys. I thanks, everyone, for participation today. I really appreciate it. You made the Truman Show work again. Thank goodness. So we'll see everyone next week.